Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You've got Julian Paul here as usual, alive in the studio on Paternoster Way, if you know where that is. This show's all about science in all its different forms, and we play some great music as well. Later in this hour, we'll be talking to RPG. He still hasn't found what he's looking for, I don't think, but I'm sure he will have by the time we ring him up. And later in this hour, we've also got our guest speaker, Dr. Ogo Osamor. He'll be talking about the London ultra-low emission zone. Very interesting stuff. Next week, and indeed every third Saturday of the month, our guest speaker, all being well, will be Gareth Morgan, who's a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society. Lots to cover today. Elsica, Sunday the 26th of October, 12 p.m. and 2 p.m. You can book yourself on to a little tour. It lasts an hour. It's all to do with a new common beam engine. £6 per person. Google Elsica and you'll find out more details there. Thanks to our friend Nick for giving the heads up about that one. It's a great place to visit anyway. Another little story I picked up on was that doctors will soon be able to diagnose three different heart conditions in seconds using an AI-powered stethoscope. AI stands for artificial intelligence, of course. The device developed by a team at Imperial College London can analyse tiny differences in heartbeat and blood flow to detect heart failure, heart valve disease and abnormal heart rhythms. It was found to be twice as effective as standard technology in recent trials at 200 GP surgeries. So I thought it was a great story. Next up.
Yes. Rain, wind and animals. Rain does not deter hungry animals. Does not deter hungry animals, and it softens the ground. Robins, thrushes, and many other birds prefer full stomachs to dry feathers and peck at the ground during heavy rain at this time of year. However, the gales that tear the leaves from the trees make life uncomfortable for animals. Wild and domestic creatures behave differently. Look for the way wild animals such as birds, rabbits, and deer move to the sheltered, leeward side of woodlands as gales approach. Farm animals range less far and come nearer to farm buildings during bad weather. they also draw closer together. Herd animals form tighter groups when they sense risk, and that includes bad weather. Sheep, which are happy to spread far and wide over hilltops in sunshine, come down from hills when the skies turn. You often see them clumped together under trees on the lower slopes. Animals in the fields with hedges move towards the wind, gathering in the windward corner of the field as this nook offers some of the best shelter.
So keep your eye out for rain, wind and animals. And some of that weather can be an annoyance for us as well. But you're listening to Live Science Radio Show, of course, here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Another story was in the press last month, and I thought this was a rather interesting one. Satellites to give early warning of solar storm emergencies. The risk of solar storms is growing, said NASA. Last month, threatening astronauts, satellites, power networks and potentially the internet. But soon humanity will have a new line of defence. On the 23rd of September, the US Space Agency launched three space weather satellites that will give an early warning of the worst eruptions of solar radiation. Earth's magnetic field usually protects us from these particles by deflecting them into space. It is this interaction that creates the aurora borealis and the aurora australis, the northern and southern lights. My word, I sound like Phil Muffett, who is our guest speaker on the 1st and 5th Saturdays of the month, if you're interested, and you probably could talk about this a lot better than me. But serious geomagnetic storms create electrical surges on Earth that have knocked out power grids and brought down satellites. And a NASA study published in September warned that we are likely to experience more of this as the sun becomes increasingly active. The three satellites will enable astrophysicists to detect particles on their way towards Earth. The data will give about 30 minutes notice of a coming solar storm, allowing power grids to take emergency action. As we become more technology dependent, we've become much more sensitive to space weather, said Tim Horbury, who's Professor of Physics at Imperial College London, or ICL. For short, more of our systems are affected, communication, navigation, and it's critical to the survival of astronauts. Last year, GPS blackouts caused mayhem for farmers in Canada and the US who use satellite navigation to plant their crops in perfect rows. Can you believe that? But there you go. Solar storms disrupted GPS twice, which meant that smart tractors that planted the crops could not return to exactly the same spot to harvest them. I thought that was a really, really interesting thing that I wouldn't have ever have thought would happen. Those incidents are minor compared with the solar storm that hit Quebec in 1989, causing a 9-hour blackout for 6 million people. Solar storms drive very large currents into the power grid. They can blow out substations and they take months to build. The worst solar storm on record caused the Carrington effect of 1859. Named after the British astronomer Richard Carrington, it triggered electrical surges that made a large proportion of the world's telegraph lines unusable. A modern Carrington level effect could cause damage estimated at 2 trillion. Get that, £2 trillion, and the risk of an incident is higher than usual. So Tim Horbury, who's, I said, is Professor of Physics at Imperial College London, and his team built a crucial sensor on one of the new satellites, two magnetometers, sensitive enough to detect the solar wind's charged particles from more than 90 million miles from the sun. Building a sensitive magnetometer, the beauty of live radio, eh? Magnetometer. I'm sure PG will be laughing himself. He'll be able to say it. Inside the Earth's much more powerful magnetic field is no easy task. When his team at ICL tested its equipment at South Kensington at 3 a.m, because that's where they base it, had to close off the surrounding roads because the tiny electromagnetic field created by car batteries would affect their readings. Ooh. Who knew? The device is able to detect doors opening and closing. It's on an arm that extends away from the IMAP satellite, or Interstellar Mapping and Acceleration Probe. It's his full thing, but it's IMAP for short, and that protects it from magnetic fields generated by the electronics on board. These instruments will also help IMAP understand how solar wind is formed, although solar particles Are dangerous to life and technology. They also make up the heliosphere, a bubble around the solar system that protects planets from the even harsher radiation arriving from deep space.
Wow.
Sensors will detect the interstellar dust to better understand the galaxy. I thought that was a very interesting story on lots of counts. Elsewhere in the news, firstly, a new generation of more versatile solar panels could help speed up the energy transition while saving on land usage. This is a controversial issue, that. Panels made from a class of materials called perovskites can be more flexible, productive, and thinner than conventional solar panels, which developers say make them ideal for a variety of services, such as lampposts, bush shelters, and car roofs.
Right, Loch Ness. And an enormous hydropower project could make Loch Ness effectively tidal, disrupting its salmon population. A conservationist has said Jeremy Leggett, a renewable energy entrepreneur turned rewilder, has filed an objection to the Glen Earrock pumped storage hydro scheme. The scheme could power a million homes for more than a day. With not Loch Ness replenished from water stored in a smaller loch 475 metres above its shores.
And another really, really interesting story in the press this week. With every load of laundry we put on, 700,000 microplastic fibres are flushed out of our washing machine into the drainage system. Adam Roots, who's chief executive and founder of the Bristol startup Matter, has a solution, a £199 filtration system the size of a shoebox, which sits on top of the washing machine or under the sink. His technology, which is already on sale in a Bosch washing machine, has now been recognised as one of the 15 finalists of Prince William's Earthshot Prize. Cracking.
Right. The Yorkshire Dales and North York Moors National Parks are home to some of the UK's rarest mushrooms. A conservation charity has found. Plant Life's annual survey found hundreds of new sites for pink waxcap and violet coral across the country, with North Yorkshire emerging as a hotspot for the fungi. Both the pink waxcap and violet coral are listed as vulnerable on the red list, a conservation status catalogue compiled by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. The data revealed 18 new locations in the UK for violet coral, a species recognised for its vibrant violet branching structure. It also discovered 300 new locations across the country for pink waxcap, also known as the ballerina waxcap, as its cap flares out like a pirouetting dancer. The organisation has now, however, revealed...
Has not, however, revealed
specific locations in North Yorkshire where the rare fungi were discovered. The Plant Life charity said that with more people than ever taking part in the waxcap watch, we're gathering the essential data needed to protect these extraordinary species. These results reflect both the incredible enthusiasm for fungi and the power of citizen science. With a record number of 567 surveys were completed in 2024.
All good stuff. And finally, the Nobel Prize in Physics has been awarded to Professor John Clark, Professor Michelle H. Devereux, and Professor John M. Martinez for their work on quantum mechanics that is paving the way for a new generation of very powerful computers. The three winners will share the prize money of 11 million Swedish krona, that's £872,000. The Nobel Committee recognised breakthrough work performed by the three men in a series of experiments in the 1980s on electrical circuits. In particular, the discovery of macroscopic quantum mechanical tunnelling and energy quantization in an electric circuit. Its implications have been profound and far-reaching. The electronic devices that most of us use rely on it, including mobile phones, cameras and fibre optic cables. And the finds are being used to build extremely powerful computers, leading to development of the quantum computer. Their work has laid the foundations for superconducting qubits, one of the main hardware technologies for quantum technologies. Very interesting. Nobel Prize for Physics, eh?
We gotta love that's cold. We gotta love.
Great track, that, Electricity by Suede. And we played that because we're talking about the Nobel Prize in Physics being awarded for the discovery of macroscopic quantum mechanical tunnelling and energy quantization in an electric circuit. Amazing. you're, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms. Every Saturday morning, 11 until 12, we should have our PG on the line. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Good morning on a rather nice sunny morning, actually.
Yes, very good, isn't it?
It is indeed. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week, then?
Well, it can't be a magnetometer.
Oh, well done. I knew you'd be able to say magnetometer. You see, it's easy to say now, isn't it? When you're under pressure,
you know
how it is, Paul. Live radio, there's no hiding, is there? Brilliant. Come on, then. I'm sure you won't struggle pronouncing anything.
Oh, don't count on that. I guess we've got similar thoughts today, because equally I found three Nobel Prize winners, and one of them's English, and Richard Robson, who studied at Oxford, shares the Nobel Prize for Chemistry with two other guys, Omar Yagi and Sasumu Kitawaga.
Well done, Paul.
So they've come up with a new porous material, and the kind of thing it does is to entrap gas, so it can be used for capturing carbon dioxide. It's got lots of different uses, and they've worked through it together for the creation of modular constructions known as metal organic frameworks, or MOFs, to make life easier for us. And it's got a large space through which gases and other chemicals can flow, and that can be utilized to harvest water from the air in the desert, or capture carbon dioxide and store toxic gases. So it's an unheard-of property of these materials that the award committee said some had a remarkably large surface area and a porous material roughly the size of a sugar cube could contain surface area roughly the equivalent of a football pitch.
Wow!
So amazing advances in science, and great bit of
I think I did see that one as well. So it's amazing what science produces, what, you know, the research and teams working on things that you wouldn't even imagine were possible.
No, and I mean, there is similar work going on in material science to use these kind of structures, or a similar kind of structure. Well, we've talked about graphene in the past, and a bit like lasers, graphene was one of those things that was looking for a problem to fix that its properties could do. And it's increasingly being put into things like building materials and other advanced materials. So a lot of this is fairly fundamental science that's creating practical things that really sort of do help. And I just thought that's pretty good to have the Nobel Peace Prize going to somebody that didn't expect it, and the Chemistry Prize and the Physics Prize to teams of three.
Yeah, yeah, amazing. Yeah, the Nobel Prize in Physics. I think one of the guys, John Clark, I think he was born in England, but he went to, I think, America or Australia, I'm not sure which. But he said they were really shocked because the work they did, I think, pioneering work, was done years ago. But it's because of what's come out of all that work that they've been awarded it, sort of, not posthumously, but I guess it's taken years for it to come to its into fruition, really.
That's right. I think, you know, we sort of got to be aware of that with a lot of science. I mean, I was amazed to see things that we rediscover that are then implemented into something new. And if you look at things like stealth technology, came out of a bit of an accident and an accidental discovery. And now it's a major feature in things like aircraft and warships and lots of other things to stop their detection by radar, which if we go back to the Second World War was a significant advance that really sort of changed perspectives on things. So kind of interesting stuff. And the other thing that caught my eye this week was that here in the UK we could be eating our first genetically modified fruits and vegetables in the next year or two.
Oh.
So when we talked about ultra-processed food and all the rest of it, the thing that's cited, it's an article by Claire Wilson in the iPaper, and it's gene-edited produce could hit the UK shelves by next year. And what she's citing is a new purple tomato that's resistant to going mouldy. So if you suffer from the problem like I have done with my tomatoes, they start to go mouldy on the stems and things, and if you're not careful, your batch of tomatoes, if you don't use them quickly, turn into mush. So it's an advance to try and stop that, but genetic modifications have always been a bit of a no-no for UK consumers.
It's interesting, but isn't it interesting that it's a no-no in terms of genetically modified food, but people are quite happy, well, seemingly, to eat ultra-processed food, which is little more than chemicals put together.
Well, I think it's the fear factor, isn't it? I think a lot of people said, oh, careful with genetic modification, because we don't know, you know, you might turn into Frankenstein if you've eaten these things. So it's quite an interesting short article, and it says there's still opposition. The Soil Association's campaigned against genetically modified crops, and I think a lot of the trials are quite strictly policed. So they've got fields of genetically modified grain that they've worked hard to try and contain and not release.
So it cross-pollinates.
Or it can just seed itself potentially and start a new strain. But it's a bit of a dual-edged sword, really, because if you look in your garden centre, you'll find lots of things that have been crossbred human intervention. Your prized roses are probably not a native rose, they're a derivative usually. And lots of flowers are sort of bred, but also we talked about it, I think Sheffield University did some research into different grains that are better adapted for different environments. So they looked at things like wheat, types of grain and spelt to see which survive better in the changing climatic conditions we have these days. So it's quite an interesting thing. And I'd say the comparable sort of husbandry side of things in farming and agriculture are sort of there. Because we did have a massive uproar when Dolly the sheep was created from an embryo. So Dolly the sheep had copies of herself, and she's now famously stored up in Scotland for people to go and visit and see. But a lot of people were very wary, and again, the talk in the scientific world of laboratory-grown meats. So actually using chemistry, biochemistry, to modify materials to create meat alternatives that don't have the impact on our environment that meat production does.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. On that note about, you know, genetically modified crops and meat and stuff, like, you know, lab-grown meats, I haven't watched it yet, but I did record the I think it was a documentary with Joe Wicks and Chris Van Tulliken, License to Kill, where they're making the point that actually they've concocted this bar or something full of absolutely, you know, chemicals and all sorts of E-numbers and everything. Yeah. But technically, they can sell it as a healthy bar.
Yeah, they sell it as, yeah.
And I haven't watched it yet, but I just thought, is the tide going to turn? Is the government actually going to step up and say, you know?
Well, it's kind of difficult. I mean, again, there's a big argument about whether the combination of chemicals that are used in ultra-processed food actually make us addicted to those foods, and a lot of it is really tailor-making the things to appeal to a particular part of our sensory uptake. So they think they've identified the centre in the brain, I think, that combines smell and taste, or converts smell into taste. So that olfactory sort of output that we get, because you know, the combination, you're looking at food, and they say the first thing you do when you're eating is use your eyes. If it appeals to your eyes, then things like your sense of smell come into play. If it smells good, then you know it's more acceptable. And things like fats and sugars appeal to us. Just from development of survival over many, many years. If you find sweet fruit, you get a better energy intake.
Yes, it's true.
So basically, a lot of it is sort of targeted to do that. And I think that it's interesting because genetically modified, there is two sort of fields. One is that we can feed the world by genetically modified crops because they survive better, they can be engineered to work in different environments. But on the back of all that, this fear factor of what is it doing to you? Because like the food bar that Joe Wicks and
Chris Van Tulliken.
Created... yeah, there's an awful lot that is legal or can be presented as legal, but equally we've got advertising, you know, and advertising tries to create ideal world sort of things with their product fixed in the middle of it, be that food or the latest fashions. You know, I think that's one of the problems you're talking about, microplastics in the world. A lot of modern fabrics and things aren't good for us.
No, it's true.
We talked about the fleeces and things that pollute the water, and increasingly the evidence is there to say, yeah, they are coming through the food chain, and now you find them in most of our brains, which is
well, indeed. Indeed, yeah. The other thing about we talk about food or whether it's genetically modified or what people will and won't eat. I think people who eat a lot of ultra-processed foods, which I would like the ready meals or whatever, they're generally very highly salted and very sugary as well. So if then you give somebody a homemade version, say, of lasagna, say, they often go, oh, it's not got much salt. You know, it seems bland.
Yeah, it is.
Because it's not over-salted and put sugar in it and that things.
Well, as I say, it's kind of designed to hype up those things that appeal to us that have actually sort of come about over millennia of us trying to scavenge the stuff from the sort of landscape around us and the things that appeal to us. So if something smells off, we tend not to eat it.
Unless it's blue cheese, Paul.
Yeah, well,
we're still going to eat it.
You get all sorts of things, but I think we avoid things like sort of rotting flesh because of the smell, and I haven't got around tasting much, so I can't tell what the taste is like. But I think all of us have those built-in sort of triggers. And I think that the sort of a lot of scientific intelligence is applied to figure out how to manipulate those triggers in food production.
It's interesting.
So, it is. And I think sort of getting along in the time that I've got. So the other thing that caught my eye is from Singapore. And Singapore was... looking at their problems with suicide rates, especially in young people, which has been in the news here quite a lot recently, and people like the royal family getting involved in projects to try and help people with their mental health. Another article by Tom Gill in the iPaper says that super grandparents save the young, and older people in Singapore are tackling adolescent mental health issues. So basically, they're turning to the older generation for guidance, and she found that many parents' approach to mental health support was, over my dead body, I'm going to send my children to seek help. So actually getting them to understand that it's a better route is to send them for help. But the grandparents say there's a generational gap. They no longer speak the same language as the young people. So they're having to understand and develop their skills to support young people. And I think they were saying that the overall suicide rate in Singapore is just approaching 6 out of every 100,000 Singaporean residents in 2024. And it's actually lower than here in the UK. And that's something like 9.5% per 100, 9.5 people per 100,000. And in America, it's even worse. It's 14.9 people in 100,000. So it's a rising proportion of younger people who are dying by suicide, and that's reflected in Singapore. But their approach is to turn to support of the older generation and education of the older generation to make sure that they'll guide their children to seek help. Because I think the old school used to be suck it up, get out there and get on, you know.
Yeah.
Keep calm, carry on. All those things, you know, in adversity, that's what we're schooled into doing, I think, in the UK. And it's difficult for all the people involved in suicide because realistically it puts a barrier between you turning to other people for assistance and help.
Yeah.
So it's... interesting, again, somewhere like Singapore is the sort of economic powerhouse of that area. Looking to those kind of problems underneath that kind of successful structure looks like a good way. And it's quite often broached here. I mean, I think there's things like the men in a shed kind of groups who get together and do some handiwork together, but it's a talking shop. It's the kind of thing that increasingly we're missing now with things like local pubs.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's so, a social. It's that social aspect that young children are not getting, and that's modern times, isn't it? Social media, phones.
That's the thing, yeah. They're sort of shunted away in the bedroom with an iPad or whatever kind of device, and it can end up scrolling through. And again, one of the problems with that is what's being fed to them.
Indeed. They should be listening to us instead, Paul. Good old radio. I think radio's amazing.
Well, hopefully. Yeah, I mean, we try and look at some of these things and look at an opinion on it. But again, in the news, apparently a lot of the large tech entrepreneurs are developing a doomsday plan.
Oh, great. That's not what we need, is it, Paul?
Well, they're, for them, because what they're saying is, what happens if you lose something like the electricity infrastructure?
Yeah, which, like a solar storm takes it out, as we talked about earlier.
Yeah, so they're doing that, but also they apparently are making sure that their facilities are protected beyond most things. So it's kind of an intriguing look. And then final thing, I think, before I go, is you were talking about solar power. And I think that the UK is still massively down the table for solar power production. Yes, we've done quite a lot of investment to wind power. And I think that there's something on the table now for a Chinese company to come into Scotland and build a brand new plant to come online towards the end of the 2020s, which I think they're talking about 1,700 jobs will be provided in it. But photovoltaic power panels, I mean, you've got a couple. So you've got photovoltaic, but then you've also got the ones that basically trickle water over a metal plate and capture warmed water for things like your heated water in the home. But like everything else, it's a storage problem, because what can we do? If we use solar power, that's great, but when the sun's not here, what do you do? Well, one of my thoughts was, if we currently draw power from the continent and from Norway via different sort of water cables, then what about the world? Because half of the world's in darkness when the other half is in sunlight. So if we didn't have a lot of the sort of problems of sovereignty in areas and the people who want to take over more of the world than they justifiably can, we could have a network of cables. And it was something, again, in my thoughts, one of the people who intrigued me is Tesla, Nikola Tesla. And he started to produce something to try and transmit electricity through the ground. He built a massive tower, and he was trying to pick up effectively the waves that you generate, but pick them up out of the ground at some distance. And nowadays there still are things that are called the Tesla generators, which pick up all the electromagnetic waves and convert that into usable electricity. So you can power some things with a Tesla generator that runs purely on the electrical sort of waves that are floating through the air that we don't see.
Amazing.
Good fun, isn't it?
It is, I know. Brilliant stuff as always, Paul. We shall speak to you Monday. Glory's Rock Show. 1, 2, 3.
Look forward
to it. Bye-bye, Paul. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
I hear clouds, highest mountains.
one bit of U2 there. Still haven't found what I'm looking for, but eventually PG did, because he talked about all sorts of things, including some of the Nobel Prize winners. You're, of course, listening to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital, if in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms. Our guest speaker this week is Dr. Ogo Osamor. He's going to be talking about the London Ooles. Good morning, August, sir.
Good morning, Julie.
Thank you for joining us yet again, Ogo.
You're very welcome. Yeah. Thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, not at all. So your background, of course, is chemistry, but, of course, you did work in the air quality team at Sheffield, as did I, for my sins.
That is true.
And we had some interesting times, Ogo, didn't we?
We did.
Yeah, very interesting area. And the reason...
One or two jollies to London.
Well, we had a lot of jollies to London to go and see our friends at DEFRA, which we'll talk about in a while. But, of course, you're going to talk today about the fact that London has met its nitrogen dioxide targets. Apparently, they've fallen to the legal limits, and that's all to do with their ultra-low emission zone.
That is correct.
Yeah,
we have to applaud them for the bold decision that was taken in 2019 to introduce an ultra-low emission zone, you know, in London. What that meant, or what that means in terms of the ultra-low emission zone, is that vehicles that do not comply, diesel and petrol, will have to pay a daily charge of £12.50 to be able to drive inside of London. The current designated area is actually all of the 33 London boroughs.
Yes, that was...
fall within the ultra-low emission zone.
Yeah, that was very, very controversial, because originally it was just central London, wasn't it? And then they expanded it a few years ago. I remember the uproar, but look what they've achieved.
Yes, they expanded it twice. They expanded it first in 2021, and then they expanded it again in 2023, August. Which is where it's at the present. And they've managed to remove or stop a number of non-compliant and polluting vehicles from driving in the area.
Yeah.
They also introduced, you know, made available some money to encourage residents within the boroughs to be able to upgrade their vehicles. You know, they were offered, or there was £2,000 available for anybody who was willing to change their vehicles and make their vehicles compliant that lives within the borough. I think they set aside £160 million for that to happen.
Oof.
Exactly. But the good news is, in 2024, they actually met the EU standards for air pollution.
And that's nitrogen dioxide gas.
Nitrogen dioxide, yes. Nitrogen, that means they're measuring below 40 micrograms per meter cubed of nitrogen dioxide. And that is a huge achievement.
It's unbelievable, because I saw some reference to this story on the BBC, and I think King's College, I think London, said without intervention, if they hadn't put that zone in and expanded it, it would have taken them 193 years.
Yeah.
That is just, it's quite astonishing what they've done.
That's true. The calculations that they did, because what tends to, you see, with especially nitrogen dioxide, when it gets to a set, when the NOx, what's called NOx, i.e. a combination of nitric oxide and nitrogen dioxide, when their concentration is above a certain level, it becomes difficult to come down. You see, at the lower concentrations, sorry about going to...
You go for it, I'll go.
At the lower concentrations, there's almost a linear relationship. In other words, if you go up by one unit of NOx, you go up by one unit of nitrogen dioxide. Now, at much higher concentrations, if you go up by one unit of NOx, you actually go up by less than one unit of nitrogen dioxide.
Oh.
Now, when you start coming, and that's related to the fact that there's a depletion of ozone. Ozone is the oxidant, which is, in other words, ozone is what's responsible for converting nitric oxide to nitrogen dioxide. Now, you say, where does NOx and, you know, nitric oxide and nitrogen dioxide come from? It's their combustion products.
So that's from burning fossil fuels.
Yeah, fossil fuels. Diesel cars and petrol cars produce a combination of nitric oxide and nitrogen dioxide, and is for short called NOx. But it produces more nitric oxide than nitrogen dioxide. It's when the nitric oxide hits the air, ozone that's around immediately converts it to nitrogen dioxide.
So we ought to be blaming ozone then? No. We'll blame the fossil fuels, I'll go.
We blame the fossil fuels. Now, the point is, though, the ozone gets depleted because once nitric oxide, that's much more in higher concentration, you know, is converted to nitrogen dioxide, there's no more, or there's
less,
not enough ozone available to deal with the others.
Yeah.
So, as you begin to reduce the concentration of NOx, you will have to reduce it by a huge amount before you can get to the level where there's a one-to-one reduction in NOx and NO2.
And so you can see why London has had a massive, massive challenge, because, you know, before the ultra-low emission zone, I mean, traffic and pollution and the health impacts of that.
That's correct, yes. Yeah, so London Mayor Sir Sadiq.
Yes. Yeah, I think he's still mayor, I think.
I think he is still.
Yeah, it's ever changing in London, isn't it, Ogo?
That's true. You know, they made the decision, you know, in 2019 that they've got to put in place an ultra low emission zone and start charging people for it. As you said, you know, there's a lot of hoo-ha about it. But it's delivered the results.
And it's an absolute game changer to be as bold as that. I mean, obviously Sheffield's got a clean air zone, but it hasn't got an ultra low emission zone, has it? And it's not applicable to cars. And some of the big cities, you know, I don't think Manchester's got any form of clean air zone, and that's still exceeding its air quality standards.
That's correct. Manchester does not have a clean air zone. There was a massive issue, resistance, basically.
Well, indeed, by the mayor.
Yeah. There's a public backlash, you know, in 2022. And but what they've done, rather than go down the route of a clean air zone, they have what they call an investment-led clean air plan. What it includes is, you know, they get companies, you know, to improve on, for example, the transport buses and stuff to all be electric and.
They've done a great job in transport terms, and that's knock on, because transport is one of the biggest issues, isn't it, for pollution, particularly.
Transport is the biggest contributor, yes.
And it's not regulated in the sense that industry is regulated. So obviously industry burns fossil fuels still in some cases, but it's always been transport, hasn't it, that's been the problem.
The major contributor, yes.
Very interesting.
And the interesting thing about transport is that it's in urban locations, you know.
Yes.
So it's producing the emissions in urban locations.
In concentrated areas. So have you any idea what Manchester did with the taxis? Because a lot of their taxis are electric, aren't they, as well?
Yes, a lot of them are electric, yes.
So they've tackled it from the most polluting, in the sense that they're the most polluting vehicles, because generally the diesel, where buses and taxis would be diesel, and they're making lots of journeys over and over and over again within a particular area, aren't they? An urban centre.
Yeah. What they did was they made, you know, finance available for taxi drivers to switch to cleaner vehicles. So that's one of the things they did. For the buses, you know, investment, you know, they invested in more zero emission buses, you know, for the network. So yes, it's a targeted investment led, you know, cleaner plan that they had, but they scrapped, you know, the clean air zone idea.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because I think the BBC report said that Birmingham and Liverpool are still exceeding those nitrogen dioxide gas limits, as are lots of urban areas, aren't they? Because if we go back to the regulations, I think they were introduced in 2010, if I remember correctly, or you may know better than me, Ogo.
No, you're correct. It was 2010.
That was a changer, wasn't it? When basically said if you didn't meet limits for particular pollutants, that it's for your health, isn't it? These pollutants impact on your health. You had to come up with an air quality action plan. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
And then
the interesting thing, though, is that nobody did anything about it.
Well, because it's difficult, isn't it? As London found out, everybody's very attached to their vehicles, and some people have invested a lot of money in their vehicles, and particularly like taxis and lorry drivers, you know, lorry companies. They're not cheap, are they?
No, they're not. Especially switching to, you know, the cleaner vehicles, they're not cheap at all.
But
and the government is only willing, well, they tried, but they're only willing to spend so much money.
Yeah.
But then when you do the calculations of the health impact
of
poor air quality, you find that it is better to invest that money.
Exactly.
And the back end, you actually save a lot of money from, you know, the health benefits of cleaning the air.
I mean, when we were at work, Ogo, who would ever have thought that we would actually get a clean air zone? But
well,
we did. But, you know, and we, well, you in particular always said we can walk, we can cycle, but actually you need to tackle the pollution at source, which is tailpipe emissions. Correct. And that's what we've done and other people have done, isn't it? But as well, I remember you also saying that these things don't happen overnight, do they? It's a step change, isn't it?
It is a step change. Yeah, there's, you know, there's been a lot of progress made, you know, across the country. You know, with the clean air zones, now we know that the ultra low emission zone in London has actually delivered.
It has.
The goods, you know?
Yeah.
Which is very, very beneficial and helpful. And as a matter of fact, when you drive into London now, and you can tell the difference.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, you
could smell. I remember walking near St. Paul's Cathedral, way before that low the emission zone went in. You could taste the pollution, and that's how bad it was. It was like a metallic taste in the air. You could actually see it as well.
Yeah,
brilliant. We have to let you go, Ogo, but fantastic stuff. Thank you very much for sharing your knowledge. And we'll speak to you again soon.
For the opportunity again. Yes, thank you.
Have a great weekend, Ogo. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye.